I run Shaman Astrology for Botanicals. I'm interested in shamanism and ethnobotany, and it's most of the plants and the pharmacology that fascinate me.
I'm Henry Cox. I'm talking to him. I'm also interested in ethnobotany and shamanic practice.
My name is Jesse Kelfer. I'm a researcher at School of Global Social Inquiry in Boston. My background is in religious studies, so I come to Indigenous from a kind of alternative spirituality, which I think is kind of appropriate.
I'm Rick Dalvin, and my bar mitzvah did not make me into a man. But the psychedelics have helped. So that's why I'm just in Georgia.
G'day, I'm Carl. I'm an Australian citizen. I've been here 22 years. I've grown over 35 different species of intoxicating plants. I've picked 5 different species of psilocybe in 13 different areas around the world. 9 years ago, after attending my good friend at Torsten's Ethnobotanica, Tim and I decided to start in Denver, Victoria. So that was about 9 years ago. It was a precursor to the incredible event that you're seeing now. I've also started 4 different educational and social support groups for people who are in loving, committed, ongoing relationships of 3 or 4 partners. Very demanding, very complicated, but also very rewarding. And the cops can't bust you for it.
Thank you, one and all panelists. I'd just like to start with a quote from the immortal Terence McKenna from Food of the Gods, which says, "The suppression of the natural human fascination with altered states of consciousness and the present perilous situation of all life on earth are intimately and causally connected. When we suppress access to the shamanic ecstasy, we close off the refreshing waters of emotion that flow from having a deeply bonded, almost symbiotic relationship to the earth. As a consequence, the maladaptive social styles that encourage overpopulation, resource mismanagement, and environmental toxification develop and maintain themselves." So I guess with that introductory quote, I'd like to open that to the panel, to looking at what they think about those issues and reconnecting to a shamanic viewpoint and to a Gaian viewpoint as the source of our disease and the source of our disconnection from the planet, which has caused our current ecological crisis, human crisis, and where we find ourselves at the moment. Let's see. Well, of course, you know, Henry, you've got to work with Indigenous Aboriginals, and you come from that tribal background of looking at societies which use these substances. How do you think they apply, or would cultures like that obviously still get out of balance? But, I mean, can you see tribal models of society working in the 21st century?
I think probably the most interesting thing that I think we could use or would be applicable for a market capitalist system is this idea of initiation, an examination of some of those initiation rituals and rites that apply to people. I think there's probably and the concepts of how the world is constructed. I mean, I was just talking before about how Aboriginal languages are, a part of the landscape, and I think there's lots for us to learn about how we might be able to describe some of these new vistas through their understanding of how the world's constructed through language. I think some of their ideas about how people have dealt with in ritual situations, take Rick's model and say that there are, in the coming years, there are going to be centres all across the planet, where you'll go and get your licence, your ticket to, use one substance or another. That's obviously going to involve some sort of, some level of ritual practice or initiation, as it were. I mean, these are events that are ritual events. I mean, it's, the very activity itself requires all sorts of parameters that really need to be put in place, or you just, the wheels will fall off at an early stage.
Joseph Gelfer, you've worked in the fields of looking at initiation and tribal models and the idea of manhood and religion and how that connects. Have you got any ideas on this issue?
I have problems with the idea of initiation, to be honest. Chiefly because if we identify initiation ceremonies that may or may not work in very indigenous context, it's something of a logical leap to then go to assume that we can kind of make some new supposedly contextual version for us. Every time that I see initiation being revisioned, it's particularly within men's movement context, within masculine context, it tends to reinforce some really quite unfortunate ways of doing masculinity and reinforcing unfortunate gender stereotypes. I might jump off in a slightly different direction if I can first, because I suspect this panel is going to quite rightly turn into a slightly kind of evangelical promotion of a psychedelic future, which is great, but I have a few kind of words of caution that I'd like to put out first if I can. With the kind of context that, you know, we're all pro-psychedelic, that's great, so these are all said with that kind of spirit in mind. I think it's quite useful to try and unpack the medium from the message with psychedelics and how we're going to be looking forward into the future. Psychedelics are a kind of a thinking tool, if you like, or a lens through which to view the world. But what we actually think and what we see via that tool and lens is really up for grabs. There tends to be this assumption that we're all speaking from the same page, and that there's this some kind of a psychedelic set of values, almost, that we're all kind of alluding to in this utopian future. So we kind of think, I think we're all roughly working on the assumption that if we have some kind of psychedelic renaissance, that the future is going to be better, we're all going to get on with one another, and, you know, everyone's going to be happy. But the problem is, I don't think those values, particularly those assumed values, are very well articulated. And what I find quite interesting, and I'm not speaking specifically for this community, but in my experience in general, there's no direct correlation between people who have psychedelic and entheogenic explorations and simply being nice people. You know, it's a really broad church. There are some lovely people. I've met so many beautiful people, and I've met some people who are like arses as well.
Joseph, I think last year Bear Owsley was one of the speakers, and he said if you give a serial murderer acid, they'll become the best serial murderer out there. If you give a, you know, Christian acid, though, you know, it brings out whatever the inner person has to be brought out by the subject.
Yeah, Mitch alluded to this very briefly in his talk yesterday, because he had this caveat that we must be careful about elitism. And, you know, I find elitism is probably the one common denominator amongst, you know, most of the people that I meet who are involved in the psychedelic community. They're all disproportionately clever, sure, but they're all kind of disproportionately elitist as well. So what I'd like us to have a think about when we're talking about this grand future is how we can actually articulate a set of values which leads to some pretty old-fashioned issues of social justice, loving kindness, all those kind of things, which sound a bit corny, but I think are really the way forward.
You know what? They're all good and well, but what I'd like to point out is we are in an extreme planetary emergency. It's not just about let's all get along with our neighbours. It's about the environment is not dying. It's in rapid stages of actually not doing well. Mm-hmm. It's like humans are really... The human consciousness has caused, direct correlation has caused the situation we find ourselves in now, whether that's with global warming or with ecological destruction, much less our own financial systems or the way we manage our own resources and ourselves as people, much less the wars and religion. So what we're trying to say here is, it's not any single psychedelic, but it's a connection with all these interfaces that the planet gives us, whether we make them ourselves or they come from the plants. It's a connection with a Gaian mind or something bigger than ourselves, an answer, like a salvation, a salve to the soul, to bring us back into sustainability and to give us a hope for the future.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great, but I think that the concern that you have here is that in a lot of contemporary spiritualities, within an academic context, we define it by the subjective term. That's what kind of supposedly defines religion as opposed to spirituality. Spirituality is actually, in a kind of in a loose contemporary sense, often discussed as moving away from that kind of God and wholeness, away from external frameworks, and more towards the subjective experience, which generally doesn't end up in very kind of useful places in terms of people being loving.
Well, let's look at practical tools then. Like in the 1950s, as we mentioned yesterday, LSD was used as a consciousness expansion tool, a creativity tool. Silicon Valley used it in all their experiments. Different intellectuals, intelligentsia, were using it, as we said, you know, to bring out more, to think outside the box. I mean, even as just a base tool, do you think we're at a stage, Rick, I'll put this to you, do you think we're at a stage where, you know, 50, 60 years on from the initial backlash against psychedelics, can the companies, can the establishments use these, integrate these as we're looking at with medicines, but not just as medicines for people who are ill, but to expand our minds to give us better tools to be more proactive on planet Earth?
Well, I think that this question about whether companies, whether you can have psychedelics for creative problem solving, I think that's one of the, that's probably the biggest area of psychedelic research that's not happening, which really I think needs to happen, is the connection between psychedelic experiences and looking at things in a new way. And, you know, I'm reminded of an interview with Steve Jobs, and he's criticizing Bill Gates and the Microsoft products, and he's saying that these Microsoft products are really derivative and they're not user-friendly. And he said, if only Bill would have taken more LSD, Microsoft would be a whole different company. So, you know, many of our major donors are people from the software industry who have used psychedelics and marijuana to help them in their software programming. So I think that companies are already using psychedelics. If you look at Microsoft, Apple, those are companies that don't do drug testing of their employees. And there's an enormous pressure in the United States to drug test employees, and they know that that's something that if they did, they would lose the best minds to their competitors.
I guess there comes a point within which if a company or an individual has a competitive advantage by using these substances, it's like doping in the sports industry. Like if Google has their own brand psychedelic and it boosts the intelligence or the aptitude of their employees and it gets them ahead, everyone's going to have to do it to stay, raise the bar.
I mean, again, we shouldn't try to imply, though, that you need psychedelics to be creative and that there are other people that know.
We don't need steroids to win medals either. But, you know, they do it. Yeah.
So can companies integrate that? I think that they already have, but not in any kind of formal legal context and not yet in very often where you bring people. Well, one of the early researchers in the 50s was Leon Solroff, Willis Hartman, and they actually brought people who had technological problems or architectural problems, some kind of professional problem, and they would have a group mescaline experience, and then they would be working on their problems, and that's how they tried to analyze whether the experiment was a success. If they made progress on the whatever the problem was that they brought beforehand that they wanted to work on, and that they found that there were some significant advances. Mm. So I do think that there is a lot of opportunity, and whether this would make sort of like a race where everybody had to do it even if they didn't want to, you know, I guess the question is, what is the harm from doing it? What harms are people experiencing, and whether that's something that, you know, we should prohibit to everybody?
I guess it's like the arms race, but it's the brain race, huh? The new brain race for new generation. Torsten, you're involved with Shaman Astralis, and obviously that's a company which looks at using, you know, plant materials, and it's seeding them on and selling them on within that Western sort of paradigm. But how do you see the role of these plants getting out into the community, and what do you do with Shaman Astralis?
Well, I have to agree with Joseph that the plants themselves will only reinforce what's already there. I don't think you can make a good person with a plant. So the idea is that the people who choose to use these plants and herbs, we make them available so that they can better themselves with that. That doesn't mean that if somebody who doesn't have that sort of goal in their life, that they're going to benefit anything out of that.
Mm. And I guess in terms of the deep entheogenic plants which are out there, I mean, this is the thing, we call them like ego-dissolving, we're saying that people don't change, but people do change, don't they? We've had all these examples of alcoholism, recidivism, and things on the surface levels like that, but there's also people who have deep spiritual awakenings from contact with these plant substances, and they do change on a, you know, significant permanent level.
But there's also people that don't have a good experience and end up not improving themselves. So I think I think there's a balance.
Mm. Indeed. Well, I'd like to put it out there. What do people think? I mean, we've had the medical psychedelics agenda. Rick was mentioning the creativity boosting and other ways that these can be used in a non-medical way. There's also the religious paradigm. What are some of the practical applications for entheogens and psychedelics that we can see in the future, like new paradigms that could evolve by using these substances?
I'm I'll take a more pragmatic and concrete approach because I'm learning soon. I think the question that came up to me when I saw the topic was how many of us or our offspring are going to die prematurely and unpleasantly because of survival issues that the world is facing. There are 6.8 billion human beings. In the next 70 years, that's likely to double. The amount of water, the amount of land that we use to keep ourselves alive is not doubling in 70 years. Every single person could turn into a strict vegan, crush their cars and melt them down, wear their clothes until they fall off them, and live in crowded communal houses. And still, the underlying cause of this threat to pleasant, peaceful human survival will continue to grow and continue to worsen. Last year, at least 10 million human beings starved to death. There are too many of us.
But where's our compassion as a planet? Like, if we could have some, not we need an external thing, but I mean, if this culture is, everyone's in the rat race, everyone's worn down, everyone's under the hammer, you know, consumed with coffee and other legal, semi-illegal drugs to keep them in one paradigm of thought.
Yes.
If we can open our hearts, which may or may not need an external antigen to do, surely we could respond to that crisis.
If we can use psychedelics to open our hearts to the idea that being childless by choice is the morally correct thing to do, that it will not leave a void in our heart, that we don't have to pressure our own children to give us grandchildren just because it makes us feel good. The answer is already there, which is we need to work on the population. Perhaps psychedelics can shake up those firmly held belief systems that so many of us do on our day-to-day habits to accept and embrace something that seems very radical, and yet the experts in the field of human survival are saying is an unavoidable necessity. We can have all the attitude that we want and hold hands and wish well and have good thoughts, but if there's too many of us, there's too many of us. So I think the psychedelics can have an important role if the seed that's planted in the head is, I don't have to have kids. I can actually help my race, my family to survive by not doing what everybody does as just something we've accepted as a necessity until now. I'm sorry about being so radical, but...
Well, can I? I'm going to counter that very quickly. I think perhaps rather than moving to a model, you know, where soil and green takes over the planet, why don't we just, you know, move to use some of these tools for people to reach a point at which they realise that we don't need that mechanism of survival as intensely as we think we do, and we redistribute the wealth. I mean, essentially, there is an enormous inequity in the world.
That'll delay the inevitability for 70 years or 100 years, that's about it.
I'm not saying that isn't ultimately where you might move.
Yeah,
you might
right.
take responsibility for that, but in the interim period, I thought, for me, those core issues are the inequality of wealth.
It's a big part of it.
And I think this refers back really well to the original question of the tribal lifestyle, because we see the tribal lifestyle as the sort of ideal that of balance of the guy in mind, but essentially it worked because there just weren't a lot of them. It was a small tribe. If the resources ran out in the area, they would split. They'd move away from that area. If we have that many people, we just can't keep on moving to new areas. So looking back at the tribal lifestyle as a solution just isn't there anymore.
Actually, I've got an interesting quote here from Terence again, but quoting Marshall McLuhan, who is the proponent of the idea of what he's saying here. Marshall McLuhan is correct to say the planetary human culture, the global village, would be tribal in character. The next great step towards a planetary holism is the partial merging of the technologically transformed human world with the archaic matrix of vegetable intelligence, that is, the transcendent other. It's a provocative idea, we can have a global tribal culture, but because of the scale of it, we've had to go through this evolutionary process of falling out of union with the transcendent another or the Gaian matrix to build up the framework to support ourselves on that level, but then to get back into it, to be synergized in a way that embraces technology and the plant technologies as well.
Well, I think this idea of new technologies, the dire assumptions that you were just proposing are based on the current technologies that we have. So that 70 years from now, we may indeed have all sorts of ways to provide resources, desalinate the ocean, provide more food. So I think it's not clear that that's true, that there is this inherent capacity of the planet. Certainly it's true that we're devouring things that are more rapid than we're doing. So there's no doubt about it. The other part, I think, is that that when we talk about going back to other cultural uses of psychedelic shamanistic, that it really is very dangerous, I mean, to try to take methods that worked in other cultures and bring them to our own. And I think there's, one thing I saw from the 60s in the U.S. was this whole sort of split between Timothy Leary, who tried to work initially with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and bring that culture because we didn't have any models in our own, versus Castaneda, versus Ken Kesey and the Grateful Dead, who tried to make out of our own culture new rites of initiation. And I think those were the ones that really succeeded and that have produced the rave culture today and others that have made a big impact on a lot of people's lives. So I think we have to take these, what we find, and work them in our own cultures with our technologies. And I think it's also the case that it's not the psychedelics that will do it. It's really the context. Because it's psychedelic psychotherapy or psychedelic assisted spirituality even, but there's a lot of delusions that can come in when people just focus on the drugs.
Yeah, if you give psychedelics to Disney's animators, you get Fantasia. If you give it Carl Sagan, you get a quantum leap and understanding of astrophysics. If you give it to Charlie Manson, you get something entirely different. Sadistic murderer in family. So
what happens if we give psychedelics to Einstein or Stephen Hawking? I mean, can we have, do you think it's possible to have a singular breakthrough through psychedelics with something that can have a significant effect on helping the situation we're in the world at the moment?
Well, we already have had an example of that. We talk about Kary Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for chemistry, and he developed the ability to replicate DNA, and that's why all we have all these DNA testings, he attributes that to his work with psychedelics and marijuana.
I guess that's part of my question now. There's this sense of urgency on planet Earth that things are coming to a critical mass, and that the exponentiating of all the issues and all the things affecting each other, we're running out of time. So if we're running out of time, should we use these tools at our disposal to really think outside the box in an urgent way?
I think it's quite true. I think that a lot of the answers are already there. We've already orienting towards reduce, reuse, recycle, and population attention. And perhaps, so there's not no need, there's not much need, I think, for brand new inventive lateral thinking to come up with fresh ideas. It's getting civilizations, government leaders, rich industrialists to accept the solutions that have already been thought out and brainstormed and analyzed and critiqued and piloted. So I think maybe psychedelics would be better, not for just dreaming up more new ideas, but just, furthering the implementation of the really good ones that are coming out from those who use psychedelics and don't, and coming up with some good solutions.
Well, this idea of should we use them, or should Stephen Hawking or others use these things, it's like, I don't think we should tell anybody else that they should do it. You know, it's really up to them to decide. I think if people were to come out, like the gay rights movement, people have come out and say, I have this inspiration from psychedelics, that would do more to influence people's perceptions of these tools, because there's so much of these discoveries that people don't talk about, how they regenerate. I mean, recently, I'm not 100% sure if it's true, but there was this thought about how the vision of the double helix was actually during a day. There was early in the 1950s, there was a lot of work with low-dose LSD for creative purposes.
That's from Crick, yeah?
Yeah. And there was some sign after he died, his friend said that he was experimenting with low-dose LSD the day that Crick had the vision of the double helix. And so I think that, but where does that, that didn't come out in the 50s, he kept that quiet, if it's really true, which it seems like it may be. So I think that we have, first off, no obligation or right to tell other people what they should do. But if we can say this was helpful to me...
Yeah, I guess that's the point. In the 50s, when it was still legal, LSD was used as a creativity tool, and the intelligentsia were using it, and it was that environment that was created and gestated within which people like that, very respectable people at the tops of their professions, could use it to have amazing breakthroughs. So, you know, can we have that engendered culture come back again? Should we?
I think this speaks to another weakness, really, in the psychedelic community. Is this tendency of assuming that psychedelics are the answer.
when in fact they're anites. You know,
they're tools. They're not the only tool.
There's this assumption that somehow, you know, if everyone just kind of got into this slightly different way of thinking, it would solve a lot of problems. But that kind of puts a lot of people off who don't have any inclination to do that kind of thing. So I think in terms of building allies, which I think is probably one of the most crucial things that we can do in terms of making progress, building allies with as many diverse progressively thinking communities as possible, I think it's a case of being a little bit more modest and saying, you know, this is one modest tool that we can stick in the thinking box alongside any other analytical tools that are around in all sorts of different communities. And if we stick them all together, we might be able to do something productive. But I think it kind of irks me a little bit that there's this kind of assumption that, you know, we're going to trailblaze this way forward to evolution, when really it's just being part of a kind of a co-process with everybody.
I guess, you know, one size doesn't fit all, especially with psychedelics, and they are only tools to be used when they're applicable. But I guess what we're saying is there a role for psychedelics to be used? And if so, how would that roll out? How do we imagine, like, the old paradigms, like Aldous Huxley wanted to turn on the top levels of society? Do you say, if they are coming back in, you know, with the medical psychedelics and other things, there's never just one approach that's right, but what do you think would be the most immediate and effective approach to...
Here's the answer to this. This is, I think, the one biggest thing that this community has in its favour, as it is yet to sell out. And I think, you know, commodification is so rampant in the way that spirituality works everywhere else, where it's kind of, you know, Burning Man is all kind of over the glossy magazines. We've got spirituality is now kind of the eat, pray, love generation, rendered utterly void of meaning. There's not a lot of selling out so far, I think, in the psychedelic community. And that kind of sincerity and authenticity is, I think, probably its greatest asset. And I think you can take that to the world and you can say to people, this is how you do thinking without too much compromise. This is how you keep true to your spirit. This is how you keep it real. I think that's a real asset.
But the psychedelics won't stop the selling out process, because, I mean, we have had sections of that community already selling out, such as, you know, the rave scene, for example, very underground to start off with, totally sold out 10 years later.
Yeah, but it's still relatively minimal, I think, compared to other kind of self-help, consciousness-raising yoga, which is, you know, when you've got this range of glossy magazines, we've got a bit of ayahuasca tourism and stuff like that going on, sure. But I think we're on the right side of the line at the moment, and I'd urge everybody involved to stay on that right side of the line.
I think in order to have these wider implications, though, I think it really has to get us involved in opposing drug prohibition, because we can have very limited people involved in research studies, even very limited groups involved in religions that have legal access to it. But for the kind of social change of a broad nature that we're talking about, with psychedelics to play a possible role in that, that's why corporations are really not endorsing, you know, psychedelics for creative problem solving. So I think to achieve these kind of longer, broader goals that we have, the main thing is the enormous social fear that's been created about these drugs and the globalization of the drug war. So I think that that's an imperative, and how we manage that from a science perspective or a religious perspective or creative to deal with that opposition to the drug war, I think that's essential, though, that we find some way to do that.
Mm. I've been living in Christchurch for the last 2.5 months. I just missed the earthquake by one day. And there's an interesting phenomenon. There's quite a few people that are giving up on the materialism. There are people that have just spent their whole life just chasing the little rabbit wheel, making more money, and getting materialistic in that. And there's a noticeable shift in people that are quitting their jobs, looking to buy bush blocks out away from the city and things like that, because they've had a near-death experience. So an intense experience, a real sort of a shock to the status quo, can get the masses to reevaluate what's really important in life in terms of, like, vis-a-vis materialism and that.
Carl, that's beautiful. It just made me think that I think we're having a planetary near-death experience at the moment.
But it's all so steady. It's all just, it's like a frog in the bucket of water, you know, just slowly getting warmer, so nobody's doing anything about it. Well, you know, a lot of people are recycling stuff. That helps a little, you know, it helps, but they still have to eat and drink and bathe and that, so.
Mm.
Yeah.
I guess we've talked about different aspects of psychedelics as medicines or as consciousness expansion tools, but there's also this whole idea of religion, and beyond religion we've mentioned spirituality. Is there, you know, and we've also mentioned that everyone reacts differently, we can't do the one-size-fits-all approach, but quite often with a lot of these plant entheogens like the ayahuasca movement at the moment, we're seeing a lot of people heal on a physical level, an emotional level, but also, you know, across the board connect to something deeper. And so we're seeing a very much an activation within the communities that fits the need for this gap that's in them, you know, this need to connect to soul, I guess. And, you know, maybe do you think that there's like a slow motion revolution happening under the surface there with things like the entheogenic movement?
I think, you know, I don't believe the quest for meaning and belonging ever goes away. I mean, I think it just kind of shifts in its form as time goes on. And as, you know, society becomes more diverse and then people have more diverse needs, then there need to be various things to plug into those diverse needs, and entheogens is one of them. I don't think there's anything particularly extraordinary going on. I think we're just seeing the latest manifestation of meaning-making in the human story. It doesn't make it any less exciting, but I think it kind of plays with honesty a little bit to assume we're at this unusual kind of breakthrough moment.
Cool. And do you want to get to questions?
Yeah. I think I should have questions.
Okay.
Another 5 minutes.
All right. We might open it up to the audience if anyone has any questions to the panellists. Margaret.
I'm Margaret. I'm a woman, if you haven't noticed. And I just want to sort of draw people's attention to something that gets missed here, and that's the fact that these ethnogens, as we talk about them, have a mind of their own. They have their own agenda on this planet, and it's really not up to us to decide how they will be used or when they will be used, because we're just vehicles for this amazing spirit, this miracle that I'm watching every day. There is nothing false about this. This is true spirit walking and talking. It is Mother Earth reaching out to her children and saying, welcome home. The biggest goddamn thing happening anywhere. So that's my experience of it. And I think we need to bring the discussion back to a way more grounded place here, because we came here to serve, and these plants are helping us to do that. We are actively alleviating the most appalling suffering. That, to me, is the most important thing that we are here to do. We're not here to talk this to death. We're here to be of service to one another, to this planet. And I just want to remind us that that is what true spirituality, and that is what true love's about. And that is what the blessed plants have taught me. And I'm very emotional because it's very true. So I want everybody to be in their hearts when we talk about this, and to stop the intellectual wankery.
Is it? Yes. Perhaps you'd like to discuss this with
It's
whatever you do, don't spring it on them, you know, that's sort of a moral and ethical sin, you know, to just like lace their coffee or whatever. Very counterproductive. I think it's what I found over the many decades, you know, dreaming the same things that are being dreamt right now 40 years ago, that getting a lot out of it, finding joy and insight and peace of mind by way of it, if that doesn't seduce them into it, nothing will.
I think the reason why we see intelligence as being so productive in helping us is because they're not in your face to the general population. So the people that find the intelligence and use them are usually really the ones that have been seeking for them, and they're prepared for the experience. But if you just hand something to somebody and they're not prepared for it, they haven't been looking for it, that generally just isn't going to help them.
I'll be brief, and I know sometimes I can get off code. I guess I am emotional as well, and also a woman, thank you. Fascinating. I didn't even know entheogenesis, what it meant. There's something I'm personal about. I came down to this weekend, and it has been fascinating. The intellectual side of it as well, you know. And I think the important thing is the emotion as well. Anyway, what my question is very difficult, and one moment of terror I had is when you said that we should start thinking about not reproducing, not creating new life. My wondering is, instead of that, which is a radical thing, rather, this is probably a bit unpopular, but anyway, there's adoption and fostering, right? What if we dismantle the infertility industry? And other people carrying 8 babies in their womb, 8 individual human beings in their womb, you know, and birthing them. And I'd love to see, like, some sort of reprojection, I suppose, with that kind of variable. So well, I can't wait till next year. I hope there's more women who have done psychedelics.
Yeah. I think that the actual fertility assistance isn't that much in comparison to the much larger number of people that are achieving it just naturally.
What about the baby bonus, though, where the governments are, like, trying to make people have more babies?
This is something where governments, not just the Australian government, but many others, are actively trying to encourage families to have kids. Perhaps in direct contrast to the advice we're getting from experts in the issue of, you know, sustainability and such. There's a bank in New Zealand that's actually advertising how it will give free fertility assistance to couples that need it as a part of their marketing and advertising campaign. So, you know, making parenthood something they sell right back to the public so that they'll go to their thing. Yeah, I think that I think that the number of parents should always outnumber the number of kids. And life is so much easier and more fun when there aren't more men than you. Become childless, but it's one of the nice things about menage a trois, menage a quatre, is you have 3 or 4 kids. And you still have, there's always somebody you can babysit or watch or make a decision or coach and train and things like that.
When my wife, well, first off, we need a new generation that's open-minded and loving, so it's not like we should all stop reproducing. We need new people, and we can do it through education, but we can also do it through creation of our own children. But I personally, when my wife and I thought about it, we thought it was really important to have a third child, just so that we would be outnumbered, so that if the balance of power would shift a little bit more towards the kids as a game. So I think there are, you know, different approaches to it. But the way we sort of rationalize it for ourselves is that we're trying to produce people who will be socially justice-oriented. Yeah. And that's a positive contribution that you can make.
Which probably has its roots in early cultural and religious issues. You actually see certain religions, I won't say Catholic, Mormon, and Islam, but who specifically give you the idea that you're sinning if you don't go out and multiply, and that they were in those religions, Islam and Christianity, were starting in a certain area where there was plentiful food and land, and it was a matter of, if our village, if our country, if our faith isn't big enough, we will be overrun and slaughtered by the Persians, the Nords, the French. and so it was a matter of cultural survival, but the need for that, the days of that are long gone. We don't have to worry about having kids to take care of us, because in 70 years there will be almost twice as many people, and there'll be plenty of people to spoon-feed geriatrics like myself and pay taxes so that my rest home will keep running.
I've got a question to the whole panel. With this sort of spectrum of debate that happens, and the way we have to talk about things being, how should we use things, what should we do now, one thing that I want to ask is, there are really these these drugs are illegal. They are so illegal, you can't get them. It's so difficult to even have a discussion about how and how to move forward when you can't even have access to and to use these things to learn more and to share them. So should we be attacking head-on in some sort of quasi-militant way these laws and make a real scene of it? Because without doing that, it's so difficult to even move forward. It really is the elephant in the room, I think.
We tried that in the 60s.
We've got one more. We've got time for one more question. We've got time for one more question just here, and then we'll be starting the next session.
One of the very extensive research that's been done, which makes sense of everything that everybody is saying in the room at the moment, and maps out the journey.
Sorry about that.
Unfortunately, it hasn't made its way into the mainstream. I'm talking specifically about the work of the American guy, Dr. Cleo W. Graves, who's dead now. But there are also many, many other studies which have looked into stages of psychological development and social change. And Graves' work mapped out about 8 different stages that humanity goes through, about our long-term move from hunter-gatherers through where we are today, or from one individual's movement from birth through to being mature. And between stages 6 and 7, there's a massive change which represents the biggest change that the species has gone through or an individual has gone through up until that time. And I think that's what we're on the verge of right at this moment. And the time scales actually map very nicely with the Mayan calendar as well. But just quickly, a couple of the symptoms that show up when we go through these changes are during the transition between level 6 and level 7, which is right in the middle of the change, one of the strong symptoms is that there is a fear of the extinction of our species. So all of a sudden people start to think that our species is threatened or that the whole planet is doomed. You know, that's just a common thing that shows up. And as that transition progresses, what happens is there's a massive drop in the weight of fear. So people, once they transition to level 7, they're no longer motivated by fear, and they start to think in multi-dimensional ways. And that transition is, I think, wonderfully assisted by the use of psychedelics, particularly the move to a multi-dimensional awareness, which allows us to consider and make sense of very, very complex things. And I think that's one of the biggest roles that psychedelics have in our society right at this moment, is helping or greasing the rails for that transition. But at any one time, if we look at the whole of humanity, only a very small percentage, you know, pretty much the leading edge of our species is going through this transition at the moment. Maybe, no one's ever done a definitive study, but maybe at most 10% of the people on the planet are going through the kind of transition that we're discussing in this room at the moment. And the rest of humanity is staggered back down these other 6-odd levels of existence or levels of comprehension. And that's why if you look around the planet, not everybody's sitting in a room having these discussions. You know, people are out there tilling their fields, they're picking bananas, you know, they're writing business plans and that kind of stuff. Because everybody is at a particular stage on that journey. One of the other really interesting things about this model is that level 8, which is the next step again, is characterised by a re-emergence of tribal themes. Now, it's not a return to tribalism. That's a common misconception. It's not going back and being like tribal people again, but it's a re-emergence of tribal themes and applying them to the complexity of our current life. So what it really represents is the emergence of one tribe, one global tribe, where we start to consider every human being as being part of the human tribe, and we start to consider our planet as our sacred land. Okay, so the themes are transferred to a global context.
Steve, we're going to have to wrap up there, but thank you for those vocal comments. And just to finish off to the gentleman whose question wasn't answered, I don't think we should perhaps be militant, but it is a human rights issue. It is, you know, freedom of consciousness. It's the basic fundamental thing we can do to stand up for our rights to take these substances and to legalise what we have within us. And how can God be illegal or plants be illegal?
And in the meantime, you can be subversive.
Yes, and I would also like to thank Margaret for a very, very valuable comment and perspective from the feminine perspective, and to finish off with a quote from Terence, which reflects that as well about the vegetable mind. In view of our present cultural impasse, I conclude that the next evolutionary step must involve not only a repudiation of dominated culture, but an archaic revival and a rebirth of awareness of the goddess. Returning to the balance of the planetary partnership style means trading the point of view of the egotistic dominator for the intuitional, feeling-toned understanding of the maternal matrix. And that's quite often what the planned entheogens do when they dissolve the ego, is they release us into this very beautiful, loving, feminine, all-encompassing unity consciousness, which is healing and hopefully will lead us towards planetary survival. Thank you, panelists. Thank you.